This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher are joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene, politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio, tonight at 7 o'clock, and podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz.
Welcome to the show. Tonight we are joined by our regular panelists, Professor Samuel Mann, and our guest tonight is Tess Brosnan. And our show tonight is hosted by me, Shane Gallagher. So I'm going to start off with my number of the week, which is 95, and that's 95%, which is the level of certainty that climate change is caused by human activity, according to the latest report from the IPCC. A total of 209 lead authors and 50 review editors from 39 countries and more than 600 contributing authors from 32 countries contributed to the preparation of the report. So to put this into context, this is the same level of confidence which scientists say that smoking tobacco causes disease such as cancer and that kind of thing. So essentially this means that the debate, and I don't think there ever was a serious one amongst serious scientists, about whether humans are causing climate change is now over. The debate's over. And it's now up to the rest of humanity to respond to respond to this. And to be honest, this hasn't looked too hopeful so far. So that's my number of the week, 95. And that's the level of certainty that climate change has been caused by human beings, according to the latest IPCC report. And the full report hasn't been actually released yet. I think that's coming up next week. So Sam, what has your thought of the week been this week?
I have been thinking about social good. Surprise, surprise. I've been thinking about the talk that we had on the radio from Mikey Goldweber last year or the year before. He talked about computing for social good. His premise is that we're missing out on a big chunk of the population in computing, particularly women and any other sort of minority. And the premise is that we need to be focusing on social good rather than just examples from business and from engineering. And the reason I've been thinking about this is I'm on the steering committee for a thing called the Review of ICT Qualifications in New Zealand, which is taking all 300 qualifications at the certificate and diploma level and turning them into 10 qualifications.
Wow.
And so we're producing this landscape of qualifications, and one of the things that it's being tested on is whether or not it's deemed to be fit for purpose. And the writing instruction is this providing industry with the needs? And the surface level of looking at that is basically saying, you know, is it meeting these technical skills that industry is needing? And so one of the things that I'm saying is let's interpret fit for purpose in terms of this social good. Is it going to contribute to improving the state of diversity in the computing profession? And even if you just look at that from purely business drivers, there's a report out last week from the European Commission that says that in the European Union, they've calculated that €9 billion per year is being lost because of that lack of diversity in the IT industry in Europe.
That's huge.
Yeah, so even if there's far wider benefits for increasing the diversity, but even if you just look at the pure numbers, the dollars, or in that case euros, it's worth doing. So that's what's been exercising my mind recently. We can look at it and say it's not about the structure of the qualifications, that there's a whole pile of things about the context of the teaching and the delivery and so on. My argument is that even if a small component of the things affecting whether or not women are choosing to go into computing is because of what the qualifications are, then we need to address it. And so that's what I'm working on at the moment.
And who convenes these meetings? Who decided that this was a good idea?
It's a directive from the government. It's being run by the NZQA. And the steering group for computing is being chaired by Paul Matthews from the IITP, the Institute of IT Professionals. It used to be the Computer Society. And it's got representatives from the polytechnics, the Wānanga, and the private training establishments. And then it's got four or five industry people on it as well.
And this only affects the polytechnics and the PTEs, or does it affect the university sector as well?
Well, it doesn't include the degrees, so it's anything less than the degree. But I was at a conference yesterday where the software strategy developer or something in a major New Zealand company talked about how he didn't succeed at school and went on to do a certificate and then went up through the staircase. So these things are important. A lot of people might think, oh, it's just degrees that matter and you're not going to employ anyone with less than a degree, but it does matter. And I think that's particularly important as we're trying to use this as a vehicle to address diversity in the industry.
Well, that's brilliant. We'll just have a quick word from our sponsor.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
Okay, our guest tonight is Tess Brosnan, who has been making a film called Whale Chasers, and I was following her progress on Facebook and was not a single hint of jealousy, honestly. And she's also writing a thesis on whale watching, which is entitled Finding Hope in a Planet of Crisis, Combining Movements of Citizen Science and Hopeful Tourism. So essentially the abstract says that citizen science is helping to bridge the gaps between two communities who need to better understand each other. Hopeful tourism is a new discipline which aspires to do the same, rejecting prevailing tourism ideology. There's much evidence of a desire for more meaningful experiences which contribute to fulfillment of life purpose rather than exploitation of people, animals and the environment, materialism. There is also an immediate need to reduce human impact on our ecosystems and for fine-scale monitoring to protect these ecosystems. It is here that citizen science may prove to be the perfect new form of tourism, mitigating human destruction, helping science, and instilling joy, knowledge, and stewardship into those who participate. Welcome to our show, Tess. This is quite an impressive, ambitious abstract there. Is this a new idea that's coming out? Or?
Well, it's not really a new idea, and it's I guess it's no different than looking ethically at what you purchase in the supermarket or what you wear. It's basically the idea of sustainable tourism, tourism that actually gives something back to the planet and that is doing good.
And we've talked about citizen science before on this program. Sam has some of his students were doing. You produced a program. What's that app on the iPhone?
The Eco Explore app, the meter squared.
Yes, that's the one. Yeah. Work. So, you're pulling two kind of ideas together. You're pulling tourism with citizen science together. And where did you get that idea from?
Well, basically I got the idea when I was shooting my film that I've just been making. I'll just throw that in there. I've been in Marlborough Sounds for, just over a month over winter, filming the Cook Strait Whale Count. And that's quite an iconic example of citizen science. It's the old whalers who help the Department of Conservation spot the humpbacks as they come through Cook Strait. And in a roundabout way, I got the idea to write my thesis because this is all based on an island, and, you know, so many people want to go there and be part of this. They want to take a holiday and spot whales and contribute something back, contribute to the research. But, of course, because it's a small place, not that many people can go there. And so I got the idea of basically packaging together an experience where people are going on a holiday, but they're also collecting data and having a wonderful experience with biodiversity conservation. And so naturally, you know, that's merging this movement of hopeful tourism and the citizen science movement.
That's brilliant. Now, Tess, just give me an idea of your background. You were born, where were you born?
Oh, Nelson.
Nelson.
Kind of Marlborough.
So near Marlborough, and close. So it's a beautiful area of the world. And so you went to school in Nelson, and...
I went back and forth between Dunedin and Nelson
a lot.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. And you did your degree, your primary degree here? Or?
I did at Otago.
And what did you do that in?
I did design studies, surprisingly.
All right. So what got you interested in science then, if you're doing design?
Well, doing design involved being in a room by myself, and that just did not work for me. I love being out and about. And so I ended up, first of all, working in illustrations and photography for a newspaper. And then moved into regional TV at Channel 9, just around the corner. And so it certainly worked out a lot better for me than design, meeting people and, you know, telling stories. And I basically got interested in science journalism because it seemed to be a niche, which is there just aren't that many science reporters in New Zealand, people who specialise. And so it kind of, in a roundabout way, led to that.
I want to talk about some of your time at Channel 9.
Really?
Yes, I do. Because I met you when we were running the neurosurgery campaign, and Channel 9 got in behind that campaign.
They did.
And so did the ODT from the same the same stable. Why do you think that the Dunedin media got so excited by that?
See, this is the wonderful thing, because it was so unusual for the media to get behind this movement. There was so much power in that. So for those who don't know, basically the old archenemies of the Southland Times and the ODT, everyone collaborated, all the media organisations in the South, basically ganged up and got behind your Keep Neurosurgery in Dunedin movement. And that was amazing in itself, that the media were, you know, getting on board. But the other thing that was really amazing is there was a protest back then in 2010, the Keep Neurosurgery in Dunedin protest. There were several protests, but the most significant one was the one where, I don't know what the number was, but it was something almost unfathomable, people surrounding the hospital holding hands to protest about centralising neurosurgery to Christchurch. And you know, I've noticed you talk a lot about activism on this show, and these were not necessarily people who would ever have got out and protested in their lives, but it was a real mix. It wasn't the usual, you know, your supermarket variety of protesters. It was everyone, because everyone has brains. And so that was quite monumental. And in a way, that really does link back to citizen science, because that's a wonderful example of people power. And, you know, everyone being concerned and getting the chance to do something about it, because the media was on board, constantly reminding people, you know, of what was at threat, and that was their loved ones and themselves.
Was it an easy sell for the media? It's a kind of an easy, it's a nicely packaged story, wasn't it?
It was, because, yeah, it was, and I mean, as I said, everyone has brains, so everyone was interested. But no, it's not necessarily easy. You know, I don't have a background in science. I became interested in science journalism, pursued it a few years ago. But, you know, it wasn't always easy. I knew that there were a lot of things to do with surgery that I could potentially get wrong, but I didn't want to not cover this topic for fear of getting it wrong. And it was obviously an important topic to cover. But no, as far as an easy sell, yes, I guess so. An easy topic to cover, no, not at all.
In that period, working as a reporter, and you subsequently to that, and you're working in Wellington doing similar sort of work, I think, did you find stories that you just, like, couldn't, that you're assigned, that you couldn't get your head around? Was some of them so sort of challenging?
You know, some things it's hard to find an angle, make it interesting to other people. I know that I'm like passionate about the environment and, you know, things like climate change and that I'm interested in these things, but that a lot of people aren't. And so things that are naturally interesting to me and my friends aren't necessarily interesting to other people. So it's finding that thing that, you know, basically connects people and makes them interested in that topic. I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but certainly, you know, I have to step aside and think, well, I'm interested in this or the demise of this species because I'm interested in stuff like that. How do I make it interesting to other people who may have some effect on this?
Is it hard work being a reporter in that one day you're talking about neurosurgery and suddenly you've got to get your head around neurosurgery and the next you might be talking about, I don't know, sewerage systems or whatever else,
yeah,
complex things?
Rugby was kind of my Achilles heel, I'm sorry to say. It was, but it's also really addictive. Like, it's a lot of fun. It is incredibly hard, and, you know, you feel kind of like almost disingenuous, like, you know, a little bit like you're treating a lot of topics like in a shallow manner, and you want to give them a little bit more time, but you just don't have that time when you've got a broadcast deadline every day. But it's a lot of fun, and it's a wonderful skill to have, to be able to switch from one thing to the next.
Have you always been a storyteller?
I think so. According to my school reports, that was kind of the only thing that was good. There was always at the end of my school reports from primary school, but she tells wonderful stories.
And drew nice pictures?
Yes.
They've got you into design. And you said you were passionate about the environment. How did that develop in you?
Growing up in New Zealand, swimming in the Takaka River, growing up, you know, in Golden Bay, and I guess things like, you know, I mentioned the Takaka River, you know, going down to the Takaka River to swim with your floaties and things and the river not being there and there being these puddles filled with eels and trout and things because the power company had turned the river off that day to generate more power. And, you know, watching these eels thrashing around in little pools of water and things like that. And, you know, like there were often whale strandings at Farewell Spit, things like that. I guess just like most Kiwi kids I've seen from a very young age and like kind of been traumatised by them and, you know, was thus concerned for life.
And so what, you went off to Wellington, didn't you, after being
in... I did.
What did you do in Wellington?
I did a ton of stuff. I acted in TV commercials and I did a film and I started doing a doco, which I now have to finish, about civil unions, the first civil union at Parliament. Lots of things. Yeah, the joy of freelance.
And you... Did you know about the Masters in Science Communication already?
I did.
Was it ticking away there in the back of the mind?
It ticked away, but also, you know, the thought of being a student again as well, you know, you get accustomed to your, well, I wouldn't say lavish lifestyle working in regional news, but yeah, it ticked away.
And what was the decider? What got you
Frozen
here?
Planet. Yeah, seeing Frozen Planet, I was like, oh, I want to do that.
You just want to see your name in the credits?
Well, I basically wanted to get back into, like, have a reason to travel and experience things like being around species like humpback whales, but not as a tourist. I don't enjoy downtime and hanging out, taking photos of stuff. I'm kind of, like, compulsive, like I have to capture it and share it with other people, and so I thought I would have to make a living of that.
Sounds good. I'm just writing that down.
What?
That sounds
making
like
a living.
Well, I suppose it's a good thing, isn't it? If you can find someone that's going to pay you to do the thing you want to do.
Yes, you'll never work a day in your life.
That sounds like a good plan.
That's not my quote.
No. And so you came down here, and you've done the Masters in Science Communication.
Well, I haven't actually done.
Almost done.
Almost done. I've finished my film. I handed that in on Friday.
Mm-hmm. And well done, congratulations.
Thank you, and that premieres along with 8 other student films on the 25th of October as part of Science Teller.
And that is an amazing, I went for for the first time, I think, last year, which I felt very guilty about because I hadn't been before, and it's just amazing. The films are incredible. And it's called Whale Chasers, isn't it?
It is.
Yes. And I was following you on Facebook because you were like updating your Facebook page, like, I went out and see.
Showing off.
You were out in your canoe sometimes, and you were seeing whales coming by. And it was quite incredible, actually, to see that vicariously. That's coming in. Curses. Oh, that's where I want to be. What was it like? It must have been hard work, though. Is it?
It is hard work. And, you know, you talk about Facebook, and I kind of cringe when I see too much oversharing, but I couldn't help it. The whale thing, it's like, I'm not enjoying this unless I have other people with me in some way. And so, yeah, I was pretty excited and on my phone Facebooking and, like, kind of getting laughed at. But, yeah, it was definitely hard work. Quite literally, it's a hard story to tell because it's about a group of people who are in their 70s and 80s who are a huge part of the Marlborough community, and they've become my friends now, and I have such a deep respect for them. And these are the former whalers who now help with the whale count. Uh-huh. And it was so important to not get it wrong, because it's not just one person's story. It's, you know, the story of four families who go way, way back to, you know, the start of shore-based whaling in New Zealand. And it was just so important to get it right. They've been so incredibly supportive by even letting me on the whale count and letting me film them and tell their stories. It was just important to get it right.
So how did you find this story?
Well, a friend of mine who is a journalist was chatting with me one day, and we were kind of like talking about different stories, and I was saying, oh, I should go do a story about the Hectors and Mauis. And his reply to that was, I'm not really an animal person. And I thought, oh, well, that's not right. There's so many animal stories that need to be told in this country. And I'm not talking about dogs stuck up trees, but, you know, the species really under threat, all the native species. And so I thought, well, you know, if you don't have an interest in animals, you're probably not going to be pursuing those stories. And I was also shocked that any of my friends would not be an animal person. So anyway, I was really proud of him when he came back from Cook Strait one day. And, well, came back to Wellington and told me all about how he'd done six stories about these wonderful humpback whales and these wonderful whalers and Doc. And I thought, oh, wow, well, something's made animals cool to him, and he's probably going to do more animal stories now. So that was how I found out about it, long story short.
And did the story pop into your head then, or was that, there must be a story in this?
Well, there's so many stories in it, and I mean, like, there's primarily the story of how shore-based whaling began and what a big industry it was for New Zealand. It started way back in 1827, and then basically how the whales just stopped coming by the 1960s, and before any kind of conservation ethic, whaling was banned in New Zealand simply because of a lack of resources, nothing to do with anything to do with, you know, compassion for species. And so anyway, that's one story. And this is, you know, so, and there's also the story of how these whalers, what they did after whaling closed down, and then how they got involved with Doc. But then there's also the personal stories of each family that, you know, that run through it. There's the story of how things progressed in the 5 weeks when we were there. There's a lot of stories, and in 25 minutes, you know, you really have to narrow it down. So doing everyone justice was incredibly hard.
And did you spend a long time, you did the filming, but did you spend a long time doing research before then?
I did, which was kind of quite luxurious considering, you know, like back in news days, you'd have sometimes 5 minutes to research something. So I did about, I think it would have been eight months of research and reading books and things, and did various trips to Marlborough, to Arapawa Island, and worked with the Picton Museum there. There's, and then, you know, did practice filming marine animals from boats, except that was kind of silly because I was practicing from like a dolphin cruise ship, a nice calm Marlborough Sounds and Cook Straits, completely different, and you're chasing humpbacks, and like nothing could have prepared me for that. And I chatted away and got some of the old stories from the whalers, and you know, having to cut those stories and not tell every single one is kind of heart-wrenching. I could have made a 20-hour film.
Are these stories that people wanted to tell?
Yeah, definitely.
Did you have to bribe them with beers and things? Or how did you engage in that?
Well, we did have a very generous beer sponsor, so that was quite helpful. But no, some of them, it would take them a while to warm up to us. I was there with my partner, and he got more stories out of them than I did, actually, sometimes. And he kind of actually got inducted into this whole whale spotting thing, which I was kind of jealous of that. But no, I didn't have to bribe them. They've got all the time in the world while they're spotting whales to tell you stories.
So what's the process? You go out and sit in a boat and wait for whales to come
no,
past?
No, it's very specialised. We sit up in a hut on Arapaoa Island at West Head, overlooking Cook Strait. And if you can imagine where the windmills are at Makara, you can see them. So basically, you can see this hut if you're getting the ferry from Picton to Wellington. If you look out on your left before you head out in the ocean into the open sea, you can see a tiny little hut kind of camouflaged, and it's the last building that you'll see on the left, and on your right-hand side is the mainland. So we'd sit up in the hut, and, you know, they can spot whales where, you know, they've had five generations of whale spotting, a lot of them, and so they can see whales where we just kind of couldn't see anything. And so they'd see them coming through. And as soon as it was a confirmed sighting, which means someone else has seen it as well, and it's not just like a hallucination or a bird or something, then the dock boat would shoot out. This is a tiny little aluminium boat, would shoot out into Cook Strait, and they would first of all get photo ID of the whale's tail. That's how they recognise individuals. And then they would biopsy the whale by shooting it with a modified rifle and taking a little bit of skin from a dart, which bounces off the whale back into the ocean, which they scoop up with a net. And the third way that they collect data is to is a count of the number of humpbacks they see over that 4 weeks.
And the shooting them doesn't scare them off?
Well, I'm not a marine biologist. I don't even know if a marine biologist could tell you what the whale thinks. They don't like it. They don't like being chased by a boat. I know that much. You could kind of tell. They're kind of set on migrating. That's all they really care about. Yeah, some of them would splash their tails a little bit after they'd been biopsied, but I mean, I've heard it compared to, it's no different to having a barnacle growing on you. There was one little whale that wasn't scared by the boat at all, and he actually came right into Tory Channel, and as a ferry came past, he was really interacting with it and interacting with us and the boat and breaching, which is the beautiful, you know, when they leap right up out of the water, and he breached about 15 times. And on this ferry, you could actually see the ferry leaning to one side because so many people had rushed over to the side to look at this whale breaching. And it's a wonderful thing. Anyone who's seen it, it's just amazing.
So you're up in this hut with your camera gear, or is the camera gear in the boat?
The camera would go in the boat.
Yep.
When I went in the boat.
So you ran down the hill with these old guys?
No, how we worked it was my partner would, we'd sort of rotate it. He would sit up in the hut with the old guys, and he'd text me if they were spotting a whale. And I'd be sitting on the wharf waiting for the boat to go, because basically there are no cars on the island. You get everywhere by farm bike, and one farm bike broke down, so there wasn't room for us to come down the hill in the farm bike, and it would have taken like an hour to walk down this in Nassauville. And so we had to do it that way. And
so one of you leapt into the boat?
Yeah.
And the boat went out for how long?
Sometimes we'd be chasing them around for a couple of hours, bumping around in the straits in the middle of winter. And, yeah, I kind of got quite seasick a few times. So sometimes, yeah, it just would depend on how fast the whale was travelling, how far out it was, whether the weather was good, whether they could still see it, because the boat's radioing in communication with the whalers and they're keeping track of it before it disappears up around the west coast of the North Island, up around behind Kapiti.
And so you were filming, it's as much about the people as the whales, is it?
It is, absolutely, yeah, absolutely, and about like a complete shift in consciousness from people who profited from killing whales to volunteering to help, you know, preserve them.
So you went out on the boat. and that was to get the pictures of the whales.
Yes.
Did you need those for the story?
Absolutely, yeah, definitely. I mean, doing a natural history filmmaking course. You know what, there'd be people at the Regent demanding their money back if it had no whales. And so, yeah, you know, I talk about finding hope on a planet in crisis, which is the name of the presentation I did today and my thesis. And there was a lot of hope involved in this film. You know, you work with animals, you hope that they turn up, you hope that they won't splash your gear, you hope that they'll perform. And, you know, journalists, people have gone up there and just not seen whales, and gone up there with a broadcast crew and just not seen whales, you know, because it's the nature of the thing is sometimes they just don't show up or the weather conditions are bad, and it's quite the little adrenaline thrill when they do show up.
So in your finished film, how much whale is there and how much person?
I don't actually know. It's probably about, I would say, visually it's about maybe 20 to 30% whales.
Yep.
Yeah, it's about 60% whalers, 10% scientists.
Cool.
I hadn't really looked at it that way.
No, I was just wondering.
There's a dead rat in there.
You've got a dead
as well.
Rat.
But, yeah.
Why is there a dead rat?
There's a dash hound. There's lots of, you know, because a lot of, there's probably people out there who don't like whales, and so, you know, throw something in for everyone.
Yeah, but they're watching a film about whales.
That's
or,
true.
Or are they watching a film about whalers? Or is it both?
They're watching a film about hope.
Hope that the whales will survive?
Well, that's hope. Right.
And will they? I know you're not a marine scientist, but what's the story you got?
Well, basically, the results are kind of inconclusive. This is just a small analysis of, like, the status of humpbacks in Oceania. And they really need to do another 2 years of monitoring these whales before they can really tell anything. Preliminarily, it kind of looks as though, or it had up until last year, it looked as though this particular group, the Oceania subpopulation, looked like they might be gaining in numbers, because the whalers have been doing this. The Cook Strait whale count has been going on for 10 years. And they saw more last year than they'd ever seen. And so it was like, it was kind of climbing. Those numbers were climbing. So it was kind of looking good, but it's not enough to say, it's not enough, you know, hard evidence to say that that Oceania subpopulation, who were hunted to the brink of extinction, you can't say that they're coming back. And, you know, the analysis is combined with, you know, monitoring of the whales in a lot of different places around the Pacific. And so we can't really say yet, but it looks good, you know, yeah.
And how many times, whenever I try to take pictures of wildlife, I'm always changing something on my camera while the animal is disappearing off into the distance. Did you get a lot of that?
That's pretty much normal. And that's what makes it so much of a thrill when, like, you actually do get something. But, yeah, that's pretty typical. You know, the cat will be dancing or vacuuming and then you'll get your camera and it'll stop. Or, yeah.
So was there a very excited test, bouncing up and down on a boat, saying, "Yoo-hoo, I got this picture of this whale," or were you trying to
no,
be professional?
No, because I've gone out filming dolphins in Akaroa Harbour before and heard myself squealing and talking to the dolphins on camera while I was filming. And so it's like, yeah, filmmaking 101, don't squeal when you see a whale or a dolphin. So I was quiet. I was also really seasick a lot of the time, so I wasn't saying much, but I was hardly going to ruin
you
my own footage with some exclamation. Also, you're not allowed to scream out whale. If you scream whale, you get fined a cake of chocolate. So, yeah.
Okay, so you ended up with how many, people used to talk in feet of film, how many minutes did you come back with? You haven't worked that out either, have you?
Was
it a lot?
It was a lot. Because everything was worth filming, and I don't know that that's like a great method to work by. Like, normally you use, it's like a 1 to 10 ratio. You use 10% of what you shoot. But mine was hours, because it was so beautiful on the island. You know, everything was spectacular. We didn't just see humpbacks. We saw bottlenose. We saw, you know, we saw orca. We saw, you know, quite a few different species of dolphin, hectors, and yeah, it was great. And Arapawa Island's got, you know, wekas and lots of different species of birds. There's even a gang of feral mini horses that live up in the pine plantations up on the hill. I didn't actually know about them until I'd come off the island, which I was quite gutted about that actually, because otherwise I would have gone in pursuit of them. It's a whole documentary in itself. But, you know, yeah, so I filmed a lot of stuff, and you didn't want to miss a moment, because when they spot a whale, you want to capture the excitement, so you kind of have to leave the camera rolling. But then again, like, our footage takes up so much space, and I only had a set number of hard drives on the island, and so it was...
So you were based on the island for the whole 5 weeks?
We were. We came back across to Wellington for a couple of days to interview Anton van Helden from Te Papa, the whale specialist who used to work there, and then the storm was coming, the worst storm to hit New Zealand in 50 years, so we had to quickly get back to the island before the storm hit and wreaked havoc on New
Zealand.
And
what was the accommodation like?
The accommodation varied. We, for some of the time, we were staying in a farmhouse with the Heberleys, some sixth generation non-whalers, if that makes sense. And that was great, farmhouse meals, staying in this beautiful warm farmhouse. And then we were staying in a very tiny teacher's hut at the old school on Arapawa Island. And so that was a bit different. Yeah.
Then there was power.
Yes, and there were bunks, and it was tiny, and it was one room. But Country Calendar stayed in the hut before us, and there were three of them. So that must have been worse.
So you came back with your big stacks of hard drives. What did you do then? Did you think, what have I done? What am I going to do with all this stuff? Or did you know that's the shot that I wanted and this shot was that tells that bit of the story? Or did you have to wade through it?
Well, it was a process of, you know, one of the biggest things we learn in the Masters of Science Communication and Natural History Filmmaking is how to kill our darlings. And, you know, every story that these whalers told was great. Not all of my footage of the whales was great, so it was easy to edit that. But it was really distilling the essence of what is the change that, you know, that these people have undergone. At what point did something that was so much part of their DNA become something that they're completely opposed to now? Because the majority of the whalers are opposed to whaling now. They think it's disgusting what Japan's doing.
This is the same people.
Yeah.
Those people were whalers. It's not like the families were whalers, although they were too, but these individuals were whalers.
Yeah, and a lot of them, like one of the whalers, actually several of them, go on cruises around the world to look at whales, go to Mexico to look at whales off the coast of Mexico, go to Tonga. You know, when I went and stayed with one of the whalers for 2 nights, we sat in their lounge, which is full of whale statues and things, and we sat and watched documentaries about whales. They love whales now. They get a real thrill from being part of the conservation effort.
Do you think we can learn anything from that change that they've gone through? You
know,
how do we get that? How do we get that process to the oil industry?
There's a lot of parallels there because, I mean, it was whale oil that used to make the world go round just as much as oil does now, all our prized products. You know, I said this in my presentation today. My laptop, my phone, probably my shoes, my synthetic clothing, the stuff in my car, it's all, you know, petrochemical and oil. And that was what whale oil was back in the day, you know, foodstuffs, cosmetics. During both of the world wars, it was considered an essential industry. And so the Marlborough whalers didn't go to war because they had to, you know, keep producing whale oil to be used for hardening steel and all sorts of things. And so that seems so aberrant to New Zealanders now, you know, being dependent on whale oil. And, you know, that's 40 years ago. And, you know, I just hope it's not 40 years before we become less reliant on the oil we're reliant on now.
So you went out to this, I'm interested in your experience here. You went out to this island with more than a germ of an idea. Did you have a script or was it?
I did have a script. However, when I wrote the script, we weren't sure if the whale count would ever get funding again, and so we were thinking this might be the last year that it actually was funded, and so it was quite a sad script, reflecting on this wonderful, you know, iconic thing that has grown and grown and grown over the last 10 years and how it's stopping now for lack of funding. And they've got funding for another 2 years, so That's great. So, which is great news.
Screw that up and start again.
Yeah, definitely.
And were you surprised? Like, did you think, I was going to tell this story, but this thing happened and that's the story I want to tell?
I was just happy because I was so sad. Like, my script was making me sad. And it all just felt so unjust. And so I'd got really attached to the story. And so I was really glad. I am so glad it will continue, because it's so important that these species are monitored for their conservation.
How did you tell the story of the whalers when they were working the whaling industry? Because it was presumably feeding their families, and it was...
Absolutely.
So at the time, it was a good thing.
It was, and as one of them said, like, it was quite a good kick, and it was a good financial kick in life, because they earned, some of them would work back at the freezing works on the mainland when it wasn't whaling season, and they'd earn a lot more in the whaling season, you know, more in a month at the whaling season than they'd earn in a year at the freezing works, and there was nothing really down the sounds to spend it on, so it was quite a good thing, you know, propelling them forward in life. And it was just what you did. It was just part of the culture, and, you know, from childhood they would be, you know, spearing bits of seaweed on the beach, pretending to kill whales. It was just what you did, yeah.
I want to move on and talk about citizen science.
Sure.
So this has prompted you to be thinking more and more about citizen science. Tell us what you're...
Well, it has, because, you know, so many people were interested in my time on the island, and so many people wanted to be part of this and come along and volunteer and do this, and they just can't have that many people there. And so, and that was, what made me think about, you know, perhaps like packaging that desire that people have up and using it for good. And so citizen science, this is like a hugely, I would say it's like the most popular example with the media, the Cook Strait Whale Count. You know, it gets so much media coverage year after year. And so it's a really good example. But a lot of great citizen science kind of flies under the radar. You know, I think people are hearing about it more and more. I think, you know, there's like a bit of a renaissance, and I say renaissance because, I mean, all humans used to be citizen scientists once, before science was made an exclusive domain.
In having that inquiry?
Well, no, basically science was just down to the individual, you know, before we had all the technology we have now, you know, things like the Polynesians navigating by the stars, planting by the seasons, that sort of thing. I just think, you know, it's kind of in our DNA to do science.
Why?
Yeah,
does everybody need to learn the periodic table? Does everybody need to learn,
No,
recognize species of whale.
Do we need to talking know about stuff? Survival. Navigating by the stars and planting by the seasons, you know, was about survival. And when you say, do we need to? Well, what does the planet we live on need? What are its interests? So I guess you have to look at it that way. What do we need to do to ensure that there even is a planet and ecosystem for future generations of us to live on?
So are you suggesting then that being a citizen scientist, I go to a citizen science tour package, does that level of interaction then with nature and the ecosystem alter in a fundamental way the way I'm perceiving the ecosystem, my experience of that process of being there?
Well, I know that I will always... now take notice of, you know, what happens to the Oceania humpbacks. And when I see the word humpback in the newspaper, or, you know, I know that I will always sit up and take notice. And so I think some of the spin-offs of taking part in, say, a bird count or a frog count or, you know, monitoring orchids is that you're always going to be interested. You know, you're always going to have an engagement with that thing. and if something comes along and threatens it, you're more likely to be politically motivated to protect it. And whether you're a scientist or not, you know, once you've taken part in a citizen science project and got some idea of, like, perhaps the what that particular species is under threat from, you're never really going to forget that.
Because this kind of ties into something that George Monbiot was saying and Neil Cossens was saying when we interviewed him last week, was that you protect and cherish those things that you know because you love them. And so George Monbiot has been saying, and a bunch of people in sustainability and in environmental organizations have been saying that because we're disengaged from nature by living in big cities, or we're just disengaged from nature, is that we don't know it enough to really have a passion for it and love it, and that we need to re-engage with nature. And Neil will say something similar to that about heritage. He was saying that, you know, with heritage, you go to love these things, and the more you understand them, the greater your passion is for them. And is this part of what you're trying to re-engage people with nature?
Absolutely. You know, encouraging stewardship or kaitiaki, it's like, you'll remember the uproar when Gareth Morgan suggested, you know, getting rid of our cats, and so many people are around cats every day and know cats and know their little micro expressions and behaviour, and the internet's covered in cats. It's not covered in kakapo, it's covered in cats. And not many people get to spend time around kakapo, but you know what, if we all had kakapo in our home and we were really attached to them and loved them to bits because we'd been engaging with them all day, you know, it would be a different story. And the amount of people who stood up and said, I'm not getting rid of my cat, I love my cat, don't shoot my cat, even though no one was really proposing to do that.
Yeah, it's a bit of denial there as well, because, you know, I know my cat's a serial killer of rodents.
Have you put a bell on it? Oh,
yes,
of rodents.
Yes, of rodents. Okay. Yeah, he doesn't go after birds because he's too lazy.
Good.
And, but we do bell him, because we do have bellbirds and tuis in our garden. And but we do bell him, but he only have to go after rodents, which is really, really good. I don't know.
At least he only brings rodents back.
Well, he only delivers.
I want to talk about tourism, and I want to talk about hopeful tourism, because you've used the hope lots of times, and it's in the title of your thesis. What's hopeful tourism?
Well, basically, hopeful tourism is... I'll start by telling you what it's not. It's a bit of a rejection of the old ways of how tourism hasn't really, even though it's grown hugely over the last 50 years, the ideologies are kind of getting a little bit stagnant. And even ecotourism, a lot of it is still based around making money. And so basically a group of researchers across a number of disciplines are saying, well, you know, we need a different way, a way that where no culture is being exploited, no species is being exploited, where the planet isn't being exploited. Basically something that's not only not exploiting things but giving something back as well. Just like the experience of the Cook Strait Whale Count, you know, that's... people who go on the whale count feel fulfilled, feel like they're giving something back. And in the whaler's case, I'm certain it's about redemption. And you know what, like, if you've experienced it for yourself, it's a far more meaningful experience than purchasing something. You know, it's than, you know, our typical holidays that we take.
Is this kind of breaking away from that consumption model of, you know, you go and see a place
absolutely.
And consume it, you become part of it, or you experience it, or...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and actually living alongside it rather than, yeah, contributing to degradation.
What you're saying is the tourist business, you know, his business, because it has to obviously make some money in order to keep going. Its purpose isn't to make money, it's to... enhance the environment? Is that the idea?
I guess three things. Not so much enhance the environment, but like that's an added bonus if it does. But basically give people a more meaningful, you know, feeling like they've fulfilled their life's, you know, a feeling of fulfilling life's purpose. I don't know that the stuff we buy and some of the typical tourism experiences that I've had and that people around me have had are really that meaningful. I mean, it's always meaningful spending time with your family, sure, and, you know, going on a family holiday, but, you know, just looking for something, feeling like you're giving something back, and certainly if you're concerned with the planet that's in crisis, feeling like that you're not contributing to that, taking a holiday. I mean, holidays are important. We all work really hard, but you don't need to be contributing to that.
So what research are you doing for your thesis?
Well, I'm basically about to get into surveying people for surveying for interest in what sort of packages New Zealand can offer, looking at the volunteer work that that DOC has going, which is not just clearing gorse, but and clearing gorse is very important, but actually, you know, collecting data which is contributing to active research, important data about endangered species of plants and animals, that research that needs to be conducted, research that scientists don't have time to do themselves or may not have the funding to do, and research that can really benefit the individual taking that trip, really benefit them and make them feel like they're contributing and actually have them contributing in a meaningful way.
But don't people use the term voluntourism as a somewhat derogatory word? I've heard people talk about things like poverty pornography, that they sort of like go to Cambodia to, you know, view people almost as if they were in a zoo.
Maybe. I don't know. But
maybe the thing that you're, because you're talking about citizen science, that's kind of like taking an active role. Is that the difference?
Well, that's the thing. Like, the kind of packages I'm talking about, and this is what I'm doing my research into, is it's not about, like, a token frog count. You know, it needs to be data that actually needs to be collected, you know, to help conservation biologists actually help a species and learn more about it. It's really important that we collect the data about the humpback whales. It's incredibly important. And so, yeah, it's basically making sure that isn't just like a token experience, that it is something meaningful and it is contributing to scientific research that needs to be done.
Right, we've got 3 minutes left and you know these questions are coming. Are you an activist?
I would say no. I'm a packager. I think that I have far more powerful in remaining neutral so that I can be a filter, if you like.
But if those whalers, for some reason, decided that they were going to start whaling again, could you tell us a neutral story about that?
Sure.
You could? Because that would be telling that story, I suppose.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've had to weigh up both sides and make the film fair. And it's, yeah.
Could you tell a positive story or a neutral story about the Japanese whaling?
You know, if I had the time to talk to the people who work on those boats about why they're doing it and their stories, what they've got going on back home that they have to work in this industry, what stops them from quitting their jobs and saying, hey, this isn't cool, we're not contributing to science at all. Mm. If you ask the right questions, yes.
Cool. And challenges for the next couple of years? Got to get this thesis written?
Yes, absolutely. I'll be finishing my documentary about civil unions and a documentary I've started about burlesque, the burlesque scene in Wellington. So science goes to the side for a little while. But after the next two docos, I think I'll probably be wanting to get back into the wildlife again. It's pretty addictive.
Brilliant. And when is the when can we see the movie?
That's on the 25th of October at the Regent.
And what happens after that? Is it available somehow?
After Christmas, I'm premiering it in Picton. We're going to have like a little red carpet event for the whalers.
Cool.
Wow, brilliant.
That sounds great. That
yeah,
sounds
so
fantastic.
Probably after December it'll be on sale.
Yay.
Awesome.
Fantastic. Okay, you're listening to Sustainable Lens on Otago Access Radio and on 105.4 FM. This has been the show for the 10th of October 2013. Our guest tonight was Tess Brosnan. Our panelist was Professor Samuel Mann. And your host was me, Shane Gallagher. Our music is sourced from the Free Music Archive, and you get podcasts of previous shows on sustainablelens.org, where you can subscribe in iTunes or on oar.org.nz. We hope you enjoyed the show.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.